Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. As most listeners would know by now, these Soapbox editions of the show are fully sponsored. Everyone you hear in one of these editions paid to be here. And in this edition of the Soapbox, we're chatting with Jesse Rothstein. He's a co-founder and the CTO of Extra Hop Networks, which is a network detection and response vendor. I think actually has a pretty interesting origin story. They started off as a network analytics play, but their customers basically started using their gear off-label. That's the way Jesse describes it, off-label usage. So despite really not setting out to be an InfoSec play, eventually they kind of capitulated and said, okay, it's fine. Okay, we're a security company. So Jesse actually talks a bit about that transformation towards the end of this interview. Speaking of, this is a pretty wide-ranging chat. We spoke about the SolarWinds stuff from the perspective of an NDR vendor. A lot has been said about all of that lately, but Jesse walks through some of the lessons that could be learned from that whole experience, and he's got a few interesting perspectives there. We also speak about cloud security, about a lot of stuff. One absolutely huge case for ExtraHop, speaking of cloud, is pumping network data from virtual interfaces from AWS and GCP into their product. That's turning out to be huge, so we touch on that. Azure, as you'll hear, is still kind of figuring out how to get their virtual interfaces into GA. But anyway, I will drop you in here where Jesse answers my first question, which was, does he think the market has sort of formed the view that NDR technology like theirs is mostly useful in a post-compromise scenario? So like quickly figuring out whether your network had communicated with any of the SolarWinds campaign C2 domains after those IOCs became available. So here's what he said, and I think it's a good answer, actually. And it goes somewhere. So this is Jesse Rothstein.
So I that may be the expectation, but I think that's because we're expecting too little. Yeah. You know, my expectation of network detection and response absolutely is that we should be able to detect when one of these compromises occurs, even if the indicators, the IOCs, are unknown. And then second, once it is finally published, that we can do a very good job of determining when the compromise occurred and help ascertain the blast radius. So I want to clarify maybe a couple of misconceptions, Patrick. You know, first, ExtraHop and presumably other vendors as well, we absolutely did detect SolarWinds Sunburst at a number of our customer accounts when the campaign was occurring and before the public disclosure. So people who say that it was a failure of detection, I don't think that's completely true. I think it was a failure of imagination, perhaps, because most of our customers who got these detections, they didn't necessarily understand what it was they were looking at. And they certainly weren't thinking that they were looking at a massive scale, espionage level, nation state sponsored.
Yeah, they thought, geez, the SolarWinds box has gone a bit wonky, go kick it, you know?
That's right. Yeah. You know, SolarWinds box is wonky. Some of them were like, it always does stuff like that.
Yeah.
Others might have realized that their SolarWinds box was compromised, but, you know, paved it and went on their way. It took a very sophisticated incident response to actually understand what you were looking at. And it took a lot of industry level collaboration from there. But then to your second point, you know, once the public disclosure occurred from FireEye, I think it was December 14th, every security vendor in the space was talking about how to detect Sunburst, but they were all talking about how to detect Sunburst going forward. And I think that was a little bit silly because by that point in time, the campaign had already ended.
Yeah, they ghosted by then.
It was time to jump into mitigation mode.
But it's funny. It's funny what you mentioned, right? Because I sort of wonder, like, I think it's great that your gear, and I'm presumably some other vendors had some gear that was able to detect this. But this reminds me of the whole Target breach situation, where I believe they were a FireEye customer. They outsourced, to some people who were monitoring their logs, who did actually flag this detection, saying, "Hey, we think there's a problem here," and just nobody actioned it. And you know, I wonder how we can improve that, because that was like what, I think 2014. Or something when that happened. And you know, as much as what you said is just entirely reasonable, because you know, we all know people who've been in that situation where they see something funny, an alert pop up, and they go, ah, whatever. Because it didn't look like the typical alert where it's a really noisy compromised box or whatever. It's a couple of alerts, something funny going on here, very easy to forget about and continue on with your day. So I just wonder how we sort of fix that problem, because it's not about building better detections, is it, at that point?
I do think there's a signal to noise question, because I remember very clearly when the FireEye breach occurred, and I think FireEye, the Target breach occurred.
Yeah.
And I think FireEye followed it with a press release that said something, I'm summarizing here, of something along the lines of, hey, we detected it. But it was unclear the degree to which there was signal on it. Could the signal be separated from the noise? So there are always questions around alert fatigue. There are always questions around signal versus noise. And I think we are doing better in this area as an industry, because we are bringing to bear, more sophisticated technology, ML-based models, which I don't view as a solution. I view those as
it's funny.
A tool
it's
that
funny,
we can
right?
Apply.
Because like,
it's not magic or anything like that.
But it's funny because, Jesse, like a lot of the time, like we love to take giant shits all over the ML marketing, but fundamentally, and that's because so many people, they overcook it. But you're the CTO of ExtraHop, right? You're at the coalface actually using this stuff, and it's unquestionably useful and part of the solution, especially when you're dealing with the issue of ingesting too many alerts, right? Like it is very useful.
Of course it is. I mean, that's what machine learning is for. Machine learning is for handling large data sets, right? It's for building predictive models. So one of the approaches that we take is that we have lots and lots of predictive models for how we expect things to behave. And then essentially when they behave very differently than our expectations, we know that there's something unusual going on. And that is a much better way to detect anything anomalous than your old approaches of statistical baselines and dynamic thresholds.
But do you have advertisements that feature pictures of cobras facing off against tigers? Because that's what a lot of the machine learning based network, it's just all a bit like that, unfortunately. Bad airport ads is what people have come to associate it with.
That's absolutely true. I want to pop the stack just a little bit, Patrick, and talk about after the Sunburst public disclosure did occur.
Go.
I said a lot of vendors were talking about detecting Sunburst going forward, detecting that attack campaign, which was a little bit silly because the campaign was over. They already knew what to look for. ExtraHop, and I think a few other vendors out there as well, we really began as an analytics platform. So our philosophy has always been to start with large amounts of data and features of that data that we then analyze. So we were actually able to go back in time and not answer that question of, can we detect Sunburst going forward, but can we detect it in the past? And one of the things that we actually offer to all of our customers, it was a script that you could run that would go back and look through the ExtraHop system for these indicators of compromise. But we took a really good lesson from this one, and I'm almost embarrassed it didn't occur to us before. But we've now introduced, we're in the process of introducing a new product capability that actually includes these sorts of, I call them like retroactive detections. So detections based on IOCs in the past that we can apply with newer information that we have available today.
So hang on. You're talking about using the IOCs to, plugging an IOC into a data set. That's obviously not a feature. I think what you're talking about is plugging an IOC into your customer's data and then retrospectively analyzing it and using that to develop more generic detections. Is that what you're talking about?
So not necessarily more generic, but certainly, and a lot of the IOCs aren't as strong as we'd like them to be, right? So, one indicator in isolation might just be noise. But if we see several indicators, we might reevaluate that and say, this actually looks a little more serious than we thought it looked a week or two ago, or 3 weeks ago, or a month ago. So the ability to ask a number of these questions about things in the past when new information comes to light, I think is a real opportunity for improvement.
Can you give me an example of that? Because, typically what people think about is, I've got this C2 IP, I just plug it in, search, does it appear anywhere? What you're talking about seems to be a little bit more multifaceted, and I'd like to get a better sense of
what you mean. Yeah, and I'm not sure how much detail I want to go into, but what we found, for example, with Sunburst is that let's take the C2 IOCs, for example. You know, there were a couple of very well publicized domain names that maybe were very strong IOCs. But then we did a bunch of analysis, and this was research that our team did at ExtraHop around kind of the life cycle of that campaign. And we were able to trace, you know, all of those, some of those initial domains to really the bits of cloud infrastructure that they actually corresponded to. It ended up being a number, this shouldn't surprise any of us. You know, there were a number of what I would call kind of second tier hosting providers and sort of like gray market domain resellers that were all, you know, their assets were all used. Any one of those IOCs might not have been that interesting. You know, you might see that run of your run of the mill in any environment, or certainly not necessarily associated with, you know, that level of advanced attack campaign. But if you see a few of those, and if you see a few of them mixed with a couple of other unusual behaviors and then a couple of other things, that can yield a much stronger signal than any one IOC in isolation. So really what I'm trying to say is there's information that we might have available today that we didn't know 3-4 months ago that we can apply and reevaluate and maybe see a different picture.
One of the
Sorry if I'm being vague, but
no, that's okay. That helps completely. One of the IOCs that I think it was like the first IOC that really was tremendously useful was the fact that this malware actually communicated using a valid like SolarWinds protocol, right? I'd imagine that would be an indicator in and of itself.
I'm actually not sure that I really saw anything that looked valid. From what I saw,
well, it was protocol compliant, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. So from what I saw, I actually think that, you know, the attackers did a good job of being reasonably stealthy, right? The C2 channels that they used, they were meant to look like embedded, you know, web font names and things like that. They used off the shelf attack tools that even if you do detect them, it makes attribution a lot harder. What I actually probably found most interesting about the Sunburst attack campaign, which of course is now extremely well documented, is that, you know, post compromise, the attackers actually followed a fairly standard playbook, right?
Yeah.
They created a command and control channel. They moved laterally. They exfiltrated some data. You know, the second stage attack was kind of a hands-on keyboard attack. But you know what we didn't
I mean, it was
really
run of the mill until they started stealing certificates and then swimming up into people's, you know, Azure AD, right? That was the cool part. But the part
cool.
in between
but
the part in between the yeah the part in between the Trojan update and then that happening was like Cobalt Strike and just trash hacking basically.
But the supply chain compromise was interesting, but not unheard of.
Yeah,
it was very well done. But there were no fancy 0 days, you know, there were no forged certificates. There was no like, really high level sophisticated, you know, new attack vector like that. You know, this was a very, very well executed supply chain compromise. It was a fairly standard playbook post compromise. And then, like you said, there were some things that I think were done really, really well to move laterally or perhaps establish some additional persistence. We know how to detect those. We as an industry, you know, we ExtraHop as a vendor, you know, that sort of lateral movement, especially when we're using off-the-shelf techniques from tools we've heard of like Mimikatz, and when we're establishing C2 with, you know, off-the-shelf tools and technologies that are out there, these are all things that are very detectable.
Yeah.
I've heard a couple of vendors, especially in the zero trust space, who like to say that this was an utter failure of detection and that we need to focus on secure, you know, architecture by design. First of all, I agree with them. You know, the world would be better if things were architected securely. I think we all agree with that. But at the same time, I think we recognize that just because something's not 100% effective doesn't mean we turn it off. You know, firewalls aren't 100% effective and we don't tell people not to use them. And more importantly, even in your best, most well-architected zero trust environment, nothing is foolproof. There's still the potential of being compromised. Even if you've reduced the attack surface, even if you've limited the blast radius, and you still need the ability to detect when you have been compromised.
Well, and I've seen some interesting people recently on Twitter, you know, pen testers and the like, saying, look, zero trust, great idea, but the way they're seeing it implemented is not it's not really a good, you know, implementation of that idea. And it's a bit of a trash fire at the moment that's been really rapidly introduced. And people forget too, right? Like even Google, which is the, you know, the number one sort of zero trust advocate, you think they don't monitor their network, right? Like, do people really think that because Google's embraced zero trust that they don't monitor their network? That's just all a bit weird. You said something interesting earlier because you were talking about, you know, the push to zero trust and also that maybe we've gone a little bit overboard on viewing security as a user-centric problem only. And I can understand certainly from a networking vendor's point of view why that would make you feel like you're taking crazy pills, right? Because there's a whole suite of activity that isn't covered by that sort of user-centric model.
A whole suite of activity. And also when we look at the, you know, initial access vector, you know, how initial compromises occur, by far, by numbers, it's, you know, phishing and malware and things like that. But, you know, there is a lot of vulnerabilities in public facing, you know, services and web apps. There are a lot of supply chain attacks. You know, according to last year's Microsoft incident, I forget what they call their incident breach report, kind of the Microsoft equivalent of the DBIR.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they said they saw supply chain attacks in 7 or 8% of the initial access vectors. So we definitely see plenty of initial access that doesn't necessarily involve, you know, credential theft or phishing or malware.
Well, and you know, I hate to go back to this Holiday Bear / SolarWinds / M365 thing, but that was another great example of where, okay, so in some cases they stole certificates and then set up an external IDP that was trusted by the customer's environment and authenticated users in that way. But in other cases, they basically took this privileged access and hid in previously like authorized applications in those tenancies. So they were sort of accessing as like a service, like a highly privileged service user. It wasn't really about user identity at that point at all. And I think that's where the detections and the model kind of fell over and allowed these guys to have woohoo party time for like 10 months or whatever.
I think there's an element of that. And just to clarify, I am by no means saying that we shouldn't secure our users.
No.
You know, we should secure our users. We should secure their laptops and their desktops.
But we should maybe secure the computers as well, I think is what you're saying. Well,
I'm saying we shouldn't only secure the users.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that was so interesting about the Sunburst attack campaign that we're all perhaps getting a little fatigued of talking about is that, you know, this was a supply chain compromise. It did occur through a piece of infrastructure. And as such, it wasn't secured in the same way that users typically are. You know, it's pretty common not to run any sort of EDR or endpoint protection platform on this infrastructure. And it's almost unheard of to run it on, you know, cloud, you know, some sort of a, you know, cloud IaaS or Linux-based workload.
Well, that's interesting because I actually do have a couple of sponsors who that's their thing, right? So like CMD is a, it's an interesting, basically, I tease the founder because they say you're starting to sound like, you know, an EDR vendor, but their whole thing is about securing Linux workloads. I think there's more of a, there's a creeping realization that that's sort of something we're going to have to start doing. I think everybody's sad about it, but it is something we're going to have to do.
It very well might be. As we look at not just the threat landscape, but the way that our own workloads have shifted, you know, I'll go so far as to say that I think cloud security is still extremely nascent today. And you have a lot of different vendors and a lot of different analysts who are conjecturing about what it might look like in the future. But a lot of this is guesswork.
It's generally accepted now that in best practice, you're going to have some sort of, you know, EPP EDR, for your endpoints. You're going to have something like ExtraHop, and you know there's obviously other vendors in that space. You're going to have your NDR, you're going to have your EDR. I sort of feel like we need an equivalent, and I'm not talking about for cloud workloads, but for cloud services, right? Like you need to be taking those Lambda logs out of Amazon. You need to be taking those M365 and Azure AD logs, and you need to be doing something meaningful with them, because that's not something that's currently happening, which is a hell of a blind spot.
I think there are a great many blind spots. You know, as we see kind of the whole market mature. I mean, just think about cloud native architectures for a second. A few years ago, I think many organizations were standing up their own Kubernetes clusters.
Yeah,
and you know, there's a pretty high burden of just kind of operations and know-how to do that. And there's an even higher burden. I'm being diplomatic. There's an even higher burden, you know, when it comes to securing that. So a bunch of solutions came to market. You know, we see this in cybersecurity all the time. We never want for new technology. There's always new technology. A bunch of new technology came to the market to maybe secure that. And whether it's a container firewall or some sort of sidecar paradigm that's maybe inspecting the containers, or something that's running on the host, you know, there were lots of different approaches. What we seem to be seeing now is we seem to be seeing a lot more managed container services that is being offered by the cloud providers, because nobody really wants to deal with a lot of the operational complexity of running these massive container orchestration platforms. So that's really changed the security landscape. It's closed a lot of doors that were previously open. You know, there are a lot of things that you can't do with some cloud providers' managed container services to secure it that you could do if you were running it alone. So does that mean that we just trust the cloud provider? Does that mean that, you know, whatever security controls that they put in place are good enough? Or does that mean that we need to run some sort of micro agent on every single container? I sure hope not. I think this is an area where the industry is still trying to even figure out, you know, what exactly does it look like to properly secure these cloud native workloads. And there are lots and lots of ideas. But, you know, Patrick, my experience has been that so many organizations are still kind of at the beginning of that journey. You know, they're still working on getting their cloud account sprawl under control, and then getting federated identity in place, and getting rid of like API keys that are used by user accounts and locking those down, and making sure that all the audit logs are in place. Just like really, really basic best practices, I think is where a lot of organizations are in their journey, that they haven't necessarily gotten to the more sophisticated, some of the more sophisticated controls or technologies to apply.
Well, and I think this is one of the reasons that off-the-shelf NDR, like your stuff, you know, that's the reason there's a market there, is because you could just buy it and install it and it will get you somewhere, right?
So like, this is where I you're always trying to help me out, and I guess I should be grateful. There's definitely a plug in there. When we think about,
but it's true, right? Because you know, a lot of the sort of like security elite, they love to poke fun at vendor kit and say, oh, you know, give me a few guys and I can build something that's customized for the environment and it's going to be better tuned and whatever. And it's like, yeah, okay, maybe. But for a lot of people, they do just want to buy something and throw it on the network and get results. You know.
So let me tell you where I'm really optimistic about at least one dimension of cloud security. And there's a lot of dimensions around securing cloud workloads, especially your IaaS workloads or your managed container, you know, serverless workloads. And one of the reasons why I like our approach so much is because now with VPC traffic mirroring within AWS, you can mirror traffic as a native service. And I think you and I have talked about this before.
Yeah.
We've worked with AWS for the past 2 years.
Has Azure brought their Spanport thing back, because they launched it, then squashed it, and then is it a thing again?
I can't comment on that. You know, I'm optimistic that it's certainly not for general availability, but I'm optimistic that maybe it will be at some point. But the AWS traffic mirroring is.
Yeah. And does GCP have this as well?
GCP does have traffic mirroring as
well. So you're being diplomatic, but you're saying that Microsoft hasn't really figured out how to make this work yet, I'm guessing.
You know, you're inferring.
I wish everybody could see his face right now. All right, so go on.
I'll say about the approach, and here's what I like about the approach, is that this is something that can be enabled by policy. You know, Anytime a workload's spun up by policy, we can mirror the traffic to it and then get, you know, some basic, you know, inspection, some basic detection, and some basic kind of controls in place. And this is something that can be done without developers' knowledge or even without developers' consent. And this is where I'll say something a little controversial. You know, I think the industry talks a lot about DevSecOps, and I think that that's something that's highly aspirational and maybe even aspirational fantasy. Because, you know, DevSecOps implies that you have your developers, you know, working hand in hand, you know, shift left, securing everything that they're
Kumbaya,
building.
Kumbaya, my lord. Kumbaya.
And yeah, it's just, yeah, exactly. But it's the incentive structures don't work that way. That we incentivize developers to move quickly, to innovate rapidly. And that's the power of cloud computing from the very beginning, is it's unlocked, you know, that potential and that ability to move so rapidly. You know, when you're asking them to work hand in hand with security and do a kind of a DevSecOps model, that doesn't really match that incentive of moving quickly and innovating. And this is where tongue in cheek, I say that the developers are the ones that cause a lot of the problems. You know, they're the ones that leave S3 buckets, you know, open to the world, or you know, hard code keys and credentials into the images, into the source code. It's not their fault. They're moving quickly. But I think when we put security controls in place, especially in the cloud, it's something that we need to be able to deploy, you know, without the developers.
I can hear some listeners licking their lips at the idea of being able to deploy a detection that requires absolutely zero input from the dev team, right? Sadly, that's where we are, right? Where that is an appealing thing to a lot of people in security. So tell me too, like, let's change gear a bit. You started off, as you mentioned earlier, you started off in analytics, right? Not security. But ExtraHop now very much describes itself as a security company. One of the things that I thought was cool about your product is that it actually still had some value on the analytics side. Are people still using it for both? I mean, because you seem to market yourselves exclusively as a security company now. Is that just sort of how things worked out, or did the security side sort of eat and take over from the analytics side? Or I'm curious about that.
So first, I'll just answer and say, absolutely, we still have customers who use us for both analytics and security. At some of our customers, we have what we jokingly call the SNOC environment, where there really is some joint network operations and security operations, or at least some tool sharing and some budget. When you're talking about something like your network infrastructure, where you need to put in place, you know, taps or spans or packet brokers, it's a lot more cost effective to only do that once for networking and security than to have to do that, you know, multiple times with different tool chains from different vendors. But then to your second question about, you know, I guess, you know, how much of our focus is security, this is where I'll say that was all market pull. We began as an analytics platform for the network, you know, the founding principle of ExtraHop.
And then you had customers saying, by the way, can you add this feature?
Well, it was different than that. Our customers started using us for these cybersecurity use cases that at the time I thought were just off-label use cases. And I would hear from them over and over and over again, you know, way, way long ago, oh, we used ExtraHop to determine how many of our servers we needed to reissue certificates for because they were compromised by, you know, Heartbleed in 2014 or Shell Shock the next year or whatever. I mean, years and years back, we heard about these, and over and over and over again. And I don't know if you watched Game of Thrones, but my Game of Thrones joke here is we may be slow learners, but we do learn, because just the market pull over and over and over. I wish I could say we realized it right away, but eventually it was more of, okay, we get it. We're going to build the very specific workflows required for investigation. And what really, really worked out well is that we had already been making years of investment on the data science and machine learning side. So because we already had almost more data than we knew what to do with, and we were looking to, you know, bring insights and bring things to people's attention. So to focus that data science research on detection capabilities, first starting off with your basic anomaly detection, but very, very quickly moving to much, much more sophisticated detections based on, you know, link prediction and peer groups and things like that. We were able to just level up very, very quickly in terms of our ability.
Well, I was just about to say you'd built 80% of it, right? So it makes sense, especially considering there's been such a gold rush in InfoSec in that time, right?
Absolutely. And I like to believe that we really pushed the envelope. We started off with all the data that we could want and all of the best features. And it's still hard. You know, I've heard everybody say, you know, certainly you can't build any sort of really strong data science practice without the data. But there's an awful lot of know-how that goes into the data science as well. You can't take a big pile of data, run it through TensorFlow, and magic happens, right? It just doesn't work that way. We've had to build up a practice over years now with big investments in data science for us to really move that forward. And then the other thing that I think we did really, really well is that all of our models, you know, all of our machine learning service, it is all runs in the cloud. So of course we can bring, you know, nearly unlimited resources to bear on it, but we also have a very wide aperture. You know, we don't just have to look at single sensors. We don't just have to look at one customer, but there's that network effect when you can look across customers. This is where in many ways, I think from an architecture perspective, ExtraHop is like the CrowdStrike of NDR. It's all very much cloud intelligence. Where we were really careful, and this goes back to kind of maybe some of my own concerns about digital privacy, is I think we did a really, really good job of balancing, you know, security and privacy of the customer with the ability to run these very complex models and detections. And you know, as such, we de-identified every piece of data that we could, because we don't need a big pile of logs to run the vast majority of these detections if we get the features right. So a good example of this is, unless you opt in, we don't even send IP addresses up to our ML service. We'll de-identify them and we'll just say, you know, A talk to B and this is how they communicate.
Do you sort of do that through a tokenization process? Because that would work. Or you just scrub it?
It's a cryptographic hash where the cryptographic key never leaves the customer control.
Jesse Rothstein, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's been a pleasure to chat to you again about all that's been going on for you in the last year. And I'll look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you so much for having me, Patrick. Always a pleasure.
That was Jesse Rothstein from ExtraHop Networks there. You can check them out at extrahop.com. If you are looking for an NDR solution, then yeah, take them out for a hoon. And that is it for this edition of The Soapbox. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in a couple of days with another regular weekly episode of Risky Business. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.